Right now, like sitting on your smartphone, is an app you probably use to, I don't know, split dinner tabs or maybe hold a digital balance.
Right, yeah.
And you probably think of it as just a modern wallet.
Yeah.
But what if I told you that app isn't actually a wallet at all? It is a vacuum, and its underlying architecture was like specifically designed to quietly suck up the $38.5 trillion debt of the United States government.
It completely flips the way we understand everyday financial convenience because, we tend to view our personal ledger as a closed system.
Right, exactly.
You deposit $100, you see $100 on the screen, and you assume it is safely disconnected from, the massive fiscal mechanisms operating at the state level.
Yeah, you just assume it's sitting there.
Yeah.
So today we are going on a deep dive into Wesley W. Fikes' newly published 2026 book, The Digital Jekyll Island: Public Debt, Digital Money, and the Architecture of Quiet Control.
A very heavy title.
Yeah, no kidding. And our mission here is to uncover this core mystery for you. We're going to map out exactly how the digital dollars and stablecoins sitting right there on your phone are being engineered as like the ultimate financial sponge.
And it's worth noting right up front, Fikes presents a highly detailed, purely structural argument here.
Right.
So to be clear, our goal with this deep dive isn't to take a political stance or point fingers across the aisle.
No, not at all.
We are just impartially examining the factual claims and the historical through line Fikes brings forward, just to understand how modern financial architecture operates under the hood.
Okay, let's unpack this because to understand what is happening on your smartphone today, we actually have to step onto a secret train ride in November 1910.
Yeah, that's where it really starts,
Because the
Nolan.
playbook they are using right now, it was written over a century ago.
The infamous Jekyll Island gathering. It's a fascinating piece of history. A small elite group of the world's most powerful bankers, so we're talking men representing the Morgan, Rockefeller, Rothschild, and Warburg interests, they traveled under false names to a private club off the coast of Georgia.
Which is just crazy to think about.
Right, and to keep the press and the public completely in the dark, they told their staff they were simply going duck hunting.
I mean, the sheer paranoia of traveling under fake names tells you everything, you know. They obviously weren't hunting ducks.
No, definitely not. They were designing the blueprint for the Federal Reserve.
Wow.
And according to the historical documents Fikes references in the book, their structural goal was incredibly specific. They wanted to create a centralized banking system that could socialize financial risk while keeping the profits strictly private.
So basically, heads I win, tails you lose.
Exactly. If a crisis hit, the public would absorb the shock, but during the boom times, the private banks would harvest all the returns.
And just to prove how interconnected these guys were, Fikes brings in the findings of the 1913 Pujo Committee.
Right, the congressional investigation.
Yeah, this is an official congressional investigation into Wall Street concentration. And they found that this tiny, concentrated group of men held 341 directorships across 112 corporations.
Staggering.
We are talking about a combined wealth of $22.2 billion back in 1912.
Yeah, and that number sounds large today, but you have to anchor it to the era to really grasp the scale.
Exactly. I actually looked this up while reading. That was $22 billion in 1912. For context, the entire gross domestic product of the United States that year was only about $40 billion.
So they controlled over half.
Yeah, this tiny group of men basically directed half the wealth of the entire nation.
It was an entire network that controlled the conditions under which every major sector of the economy operated. Banking, railroads, utility. They had a seat at every table that mattered. They
Right.
didn't just participate in the market, they controlled the environment of the market itself.
Well, and Fikes brings up an analogy from the book that really made this click for me. It's about William Wallace Cargill in 1865.
Ah, yes, the grain
Yeah,
elevators.
the guy who built the massive Cargill agriculture empire. He didn't go out and buy a bunch of individual farms. I mean, that is too much work and way too much risk.
Right.
Instead, he bought the grain elevators at the railroad terminals. So the real power isn't in making the product, it's in owning the choke point infrastructure everyone needs to use to move the product.
That mechanism is the absolute core of the book's
It
thesis.
makes so much sense.
It really does. Rockefeller did the exact same thing with oil refineries and pipelines. Cargill did it with grain storage. And the men at Jekyll Island applied that exact infrastructure control model to money and credit.
Right.
But Morgan and the Jekyll Island crew, they didn't invent this concept.
Oh, really?
No, to truly understand how they built a system to get away with this without, you know, triggering a massive public revolt, Fikes takes us about 400 years further into the past.
Oh, we are talking about the Dutch, right?
Yeah.
The 1600s.
1602, to be precise. Fikes details a core mechanism he calls the separation principle.
Okay, what is that?
It is a deliberate architectural split between the people who provide the capital and the people who make the decisions.
Ah, got it.
So the Dutch East India Company, the VOC, they basically pioneered this structure. They needed an unprecedented amount of money to fund these massive global trade fleets, right?
Yeah, ships are expensive.
Exactly. So they raised capital from everyday people, a group called the Participentin.
So these are essentially the early shareholders. They provide the money, they get their dividends, and they are, you know, perfectly happy.
Happy, but entirely powerless.
Oh.
The participant had absolutely no voting rights. They couldn't inspect the financial books. They couldn't dictate trade strategy.
So they were just along for the ride.
Basically. All of the operational power, all the real control, mm-hmm. was concentrated and held by a board of just 17 directors known as the Heeren 17 or the Gentlemen 17.
Wow. You know, this reminds me of one of those massive crowdfunding platforms online. Like, say you back a highly anticipated video game on Kickstarter.
Okay.
You and a million other people give them the money. You might eventually get a copy of the game, but you don't get to tell the developers how to code it, who to hire, or what features to cut.
Exactly.
You supply the capital, but you have zero operational authority.
That is a perfect modern parallel. Fikes calls this ratio broad participation, narrow control.
Broad participation, narrow control.
Right. And if we connect this to the bigger picture of today's financial markets, this exact dynamic is hiding in plain sight.
Wait, really? Where?
Look at the big three index funds. State Street, Vanguard, and BlackRock.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Millions of you listening right now routinely put your hard-earned savings into 401k managed by these firms. You are the capital providers.
I supply the money, and I get the economic returns when the market goes up.
Yeah.
But I definitely don't get a say in how the underlying companies are run.
Because the big three hold what are called proxy voting rights.
Right.
When you buy an index fund, you don't technically own the voting shares of Apple or Exxon. The fund does. They take the combined capital of millions of everyday workers and use it to cast proxy votes across almost every major corporation in America.
That's wild.
They use your money to decide who sits on corporate boards and what corporate policies are adopted.
Broad participation, narrow control. It is the Dutch East India Company all over again.
It really is.
And Fikes points out that this exact separation principle was just hard-coded into the law with the 2025 Genius Act. He highlights the creation of the Stablecoin Certification Review Committee, the SCRC.
Yes, the SCRC. Under this new digital money framework, just three unelected officials, the Treasury Secretary, the Fed Chair, and the FDIC Chair, hold the ultimate regulatory choke point over the entire stablecoin ecosystem.
Just three people.
Just three. Millions of users will provide the capital by using these digital coins, but just three offices make the rules stating how that money functions.
It's an incredibly effective playbook. And, I mean, it has worked flawlessly for a century to centralize power while keeping the public sedated with, you know, dividends and convenience.
Yep.
But here is the crux of Fikes' entire book. The math behind this playbook is finally breaking.
It's breaking down.
Because the United States' gross federal debt is currently hovering around $38.5 trillion.
And to understand why a number that large completely breaks the historical architecture, Fikes breaks down what he calls the five innovations of permanent debt from 1694 to the present.
Okay.
This sequence explains how we slowly trapped ourselves in a mathematical corner.
Okay, I want to go through these carefully because the evolution here is just wild. Mm-hmm. The first innovation happens in 1694 with the creation of the Bank of England.
Right. This is the invention of perpetual sovereign debt.
Meaning what, exactly?
Well, before this, if a king borrowed money for a war, he had to eventually pay back the actual loan amount, the principal.
Right, like a normal loan.
Exactly. The Bank of England changed the game. They created a system where the government doesn't borrow to pay something off. It borrows permanently.
Permanently.
Yes. It just promises to service the interest forever. It shifts the burden from solving the debt to merely managing the carrying costs.
Which opens the door for endless borrowing as long as you can make the monthly minimum payment.
Exactly like a credit card you never pay down.
Right. So then Fikes lists the second innovation as coming in the 1800s via the Rothschild banking family, tradable global debt.
Right, so the central bank backstop mechanism. The Federal Reserve was created in part to be the buyer of last resort.
The ultimate safety net.
Right. If the market panics and nobody wants to buy government debt, the central bank steps in with newly created money to absorb it, ensuring the government never fails an auction.
Okay, but here's where Fikes lost me a bit in the book. The fourth innovation. He talks about the 1980s, the Volcker era, and the International Monetary Fund.
The IMF, yeah.
He calls the rule, restructure, don't forgive. How does restructuring debt actually benefit this system more than just wiping the slate clean?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, wouldn't a clean slate let a struggling country get back on its feet?
Well, a clean slate would benefit the struggling country, yes, but it would completely devastate the balance sheets of the global banks holding that debt.
Oh, because they'd have to take the loss.
Exactly. Taking a massive loss is unacceptable to the financial architecture. So when developing nations in Latin America faced catastrophic defaults in the 1980s, the IMF standardized a new approach. You never cancel the debt. Instead, you restructure it. You extend the repayment timeline. You issue new loans to help them pay the interest on the old loans. And you force the country into strict austerity measures.
Wow. You essentially trap them in a permanent loop where they are just working to pay the interest. They never escape.
The principal is preserved, the interest keeps flowing, and the banks don't have to report a loss.
That is brutal.
They kick the can down the road globally. But all of these innovations bring us to the fifth and final phase, which is happening right now. Digital rails for public exposure.
Because that $38.5 trillion problem has grown way too heavy.
Much too heavy.
I mean, the interest payments alone on the U.S. debt are now rivaling the costs of major federal programs like defense and healthcare.
It's eating the budget.
Yeah, and the old reliable buyers of our debt foreign nations like China, who used to buy our treasury bonds by the truckload and even our own Federal Reserve, they're either tapped out or strategically backing away.
Right. The historical absorbers of this debt simply cannot carry any more without causing hyperinflation or breaking the global system. They need a new, massive, and entirely captive buyer.
Okay, and here's where it gets really interesting. This is where my mind was completely blown.
Yeah, it's quite the reveal.
If the old buyers are tapped out, where does the new money come from? The government isn't knocking on my door, forcing me to buy U.S. Treasury bonds. I'm not writing a check to the Treasury. So how am I footing the bill?
You aren't being forced to buy bonds through coercion. You are being enrolled through convenience.
Enrolled through convenience.
Yes, this is what Fikes means by the digital Jekyll Island. The infrastructure of digital money is the new grain elevator.
Let's break down the exact mechanics of this step by step because it is brilliant and terrifying.
Let's do it.
Let's say I take $10,000 of my hard-earned physical cash and I convert it into a digital stablecoin on a popular crypto exchange or, you know, a payment app on my phone. From my perspective as a user, I just upgraded my money.
Yeah.
I bought transaction speed. I can send that 10 grand to a friend across the globe in 3 seconds on a Saturday night.
Right. The user experience is frictionless, it's modern, and it's highly appealing. But look at what happens on the back end beneath the interface.
What happened?
The company issuing that stablecoin doesn't just put your 10,000 physical dollars in a digital vault to sit there. They take your real cash and they use it to buy short-term U.S. Treasury bills.
Which means they are taking my money and buying government debt.
Precisely. And this requires understanding a critical financial distinction Fikes makes between an asset and a claim.
Okay, an asset and a claim.
Think of physical cash or like a physical gold coin as an asset. When you hold it in your hand, it has no counterparty risk. Its existence doesn't rely on anyone else fulfilling a promise.
Right. If I have a $100 bill in my wallet, it doesn't matter if my bank's servers crash or if an app goes bankrupt. The bill is still $100.
Exactly. But a digital stablecoin is a claim. It is a digital IOU. It is literally just a digital receipt that says some company somewhere promises they owe you that value.
So the public, you and me, we are left holding the digital claim. We bear 100% of the counterparty risk.
You carry all the risk.
If the stablecoin platform freezes, gets hacked, or goes bankrupt, we're just standing in line at bankruptcy court. But the issuer, they hold the actual asset, the treasury bill, and they get paid the interest, the yield, from the government.
Think about the math. If short-term treasuries are yielding 5%, the stablecoin issuer is pocketing $500 a year off your $10,000, doing absolutely nothing but holding the infrastructure.
Oh, wow.
They keep the profit, you keep the risk, and the government. The government gets a steady, infinite reservoir of demand for its massive debt.
Wait, so I am unknowingly becoming the ultimate debt absorber?
Yes.
The system transforms my desire for a faster digital transaction into a lifeline for sovereign debt?
Yeah.
It is genius because it's totally invisible.
Completely invisible.
The system doesn't need to come to your house and confiscate your wealth. It doesn't need to raise your taxes in a way that makes you angry enough to vote them out. It just needs millions of people casually using its digital payment rails to buy coffee, split rent, or trade online.
The infrastructure quietly redirects the capital of the masses to sustain the architecture of the state.
But why do we step onto these rails so willingly? I mean, when you lay it out like this, the trap seems obvious. Why don't people see what is happening to their money?
Well, this is where FIKES shifts from financial mechanics to mass psychology.
Oh, psychology.
Yeah, because the transition is achieved without triggering any public revolt, because it relies heavily on financial euphemisms. The industry uses language to completely neutralize the perceived threat.
Like how they describe the government debt itself.
Exactly.
When you call it government debt, everyday people get nervous. It sounds like a liability. It sounds like a deficit. So Wall Street simply rebrands it as a risk-free asset.
Think about the psychological impact of those words.
Mm.
Risk-free. Or consider the word surveillance. No citizen wants total financial surveillance of their daily purchases. So the industry rebrands it as regulatory compliance.
Oh, of course.
We think of an offshore account as a literal geographic island with palm trees and a guy in a linen suit. But in reality, offshore just means a legal gap where domestic regulations don't apply. It could be a server in Delaware.
Wow.
Language actively hides the risk from the user.
And that ties perfectly into what might be the most profound analogy in the entire book. FIKES compares two very famous dystopian novels and argues that we as a society have been trained to look for the completely wrong kind of tyranny.
It's a great comparison. When we envision dystopian control, we almost instinctively jump to George Orwell's 1984.
Yeah, the classic.
We picture a boot stamping on a human face. We look for overt violence, forced compliance, visible dictators, and absolute misery.
But FIKES says this new financial architecture doesn't work like Orwell. It works like Aldous Huxley's Brave New World.
Right. Because in Huxley's vision of the future, people aren't controlled through pain. They are controlled through pleasure, distraction, and overwhelming convenience.
I like it.
They learn to love the technologies that strip them of their autonomy. The digital Jekyll Island operates entirely on Huxley's principles.
Oh, I see.
It offers you instant settlement, beautiful gamified app interfaces, seamless cross-border transfers, and cashback rewards.
The front end of the system feels incredibly empowering. It is voluntary, it is frictionless, and it makes your life easier.
But while you are swiping your phone and earning rewards on the Huxley front end, your participation is quietly building the back-end infrastructure for Orwell. You are transitioning your wealth into a system where money becomes entirely monitorable, programmable, and conditional.
And if your ability to buy groceries or pay rent is conditional on a digital system you do not govern, controlled by the Gentleman 17 of our modern era, are you truly an independent economic actor?
It forces us to ask how we define freedom in the digital age. Because if your balances are silently propping up a sovereign debt machine you never voted to finance, your economic energy has been completely captured.
So, what does this all mean?
Yeah.
If we step back and synthesize everything we've pulled from FIKES' research today, the fundamental nature of the money in your pocket is undergoing a radical transition.
It really is.
It is shifting from a private bearer asset, where you have total undeniable control, into a conditional, programmable IOU.
Yep.
And without ever being asked, without ever signing a disclosure, you are being drafted as the new buyer of last resort for a system that is hopelessly addicted to debt.
And as this digital infrastructure hardens into place, the exits to physical cash and alternative systems are quietly being closed.
Slowly but surely.
The system won't outlaw cash by force. It will just make using it so wildly inconvenient that people voluntarily give it up.
We want to leave you with a brand new, frankly chilling thought to mull over, inspired by a recurring phrase FIKES uses throughout the book, "The ledger remembers."
Such a powerful phrase.
Think about the implications of this. If physical cash disappears entirely, and every single digital transaction you ever make, every coffee, every donation, every book purchase, is permanently recorded on a centralized, programmable ledger, what happens if the rules of society change retroactively?
It exposes the individual to an unprecedented level of vulnerability.
Could a future government administration or even an automated compliance algorithm decide to financially penalize you tomorrow for a perfectly legal purchase you make today simply because the ledger never forgets and your money is no longer entirely yours?
Right, because once the architecture of quiet control is fully built, the definition of what is allowed can be rewritten at any time.
And as Fikes makes clear, the foundation for that architecture is already being poured.
It's happening right now.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the digital Jekyll Island. Stay curious, keep reading, and always, always question the architecture operating beneath your convenience.